Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
My next interview is with Cameron Molyneux, and we talk about her new film, Exit Music, something that Variety magazine has called a toughly moving study of a cystic fibrosis patient's final months. It is a thoughtful film. It is an engaging piece. It's heartbreaking. It's touching. It's tragic. It's difficult, but it's also ultimately absolutely brilliant in its existential, philosophical, and it's life-giving hope. And this last line that I think Cameron and I do actually get to at some point in our conversation about how we are in fact hardwired to live. We're hardwired to live. We're guided by love. I mean, how is that so? I mean, it's just so relevant to pretty much everything we do. We talk about trauma and loss, and we talk about this young man who is dealing with his impending death, and he knows it. He's 28 years old. His name's Ethan. He's an artist. He's a filmmaker. He's a musician. He's got a wonderful supportive family around him. And we talk about identity, and we talk about living and dying, and about how do we deal with life in a more human and maybe almost short-term kind of a way. We talk about honesty and authenticity and trust, and we get into conversations, and we've done this before in face-to-face about palliative care as well. And so there's a lot here. You need to see the film as well. Exit Music is the title, and it's coming right up. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and speaking. Face2facelive.ca for a slew of other... Does anyone use the word slew anymore? For a lot of other interviews there from Hot Docs and Exit Music. Was at Hot Docs this year, and you're going to be seeing it soon enough, I'm sure. And of course, if you want to support the work I'm doing at Face2Face and get behind it, you can do that monthly through patreon.com. Coming right up, Cameron Molyneux and her new film, Exit Music.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here with us today. Cameron Molyneux is here today to talk about her new film, Exit Music. And I am absolutely thrilled that we were about to step into this conversation. Been looking forward to this one for some time. Cameron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So you're back home, which I think is like kind of West Coast. So we're 3 hours time difference. You're just, I think, coming off Hot Docs. What does it feel like to be back? Can you give us a little bit of that Torontonian-like buzz maybe that you're still enjoying?
For sure. Yeah, I'm back in San Francisco. We just had the premiere of Exit Music at Hot Docs. My first time in Toronto, and I have to say... the nicest people live in Toronto. Everyone was just so gracious. And, I mean, it's a huge festival, and you get lost in the whole, you know, mix of it. But it felt very, like, homey and welcoming, and was just an incredible reception for this film. It was our first audience.
So why the nicest people in Toronto? Because I'm pretty sure Torontonians may not agree with you on that. But
really?
Yeah, they may not. They may not. I've heard before Torontonians don't make eye contact.
Well, maybe it has to do with the hot dog staff because just such kindness. People, they're huge film lovers, and so just the people at Hot Docs were very welcoming.
Well, that's a pretty good review of your time up here, and it was your first visit, and so I guess I'm going to say you're probably coming back.
For sure.
Yeah, amazing. Well, hopefully you're coming back for another film, and that's down the road, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit later on in the conversation. But tell us about Exit Music. Tell us maybe, I don't know, set a little tone for us. Certainly, I've got lots of questions for you. It's a challenging film. You know what? If it's okay with you, I'm gonna start with a quote from a Variety review recently. Quote, Exit Music covers the spectrum, and we're going to talk about what that spectrum is. This is lovely, by the way, Cameron, with grace, good humor, and no emotional filter. It's an unabashed tearjerker that earns its salt water through candor rather than undue manipulation, an audience favorite at Hot Docs, close quote. Wow, that's out of the park from Variety. What's your take after several years of being, you know, editing, directing, in the middle of it all? Can you tell us where we can start as an audience as we listen in?
Yeah, so I can talk more about this a little later, but I have been involved in studying death and dying for many years. It was just this strange fascination that I had as a 19-year-old, kind of moving out into the world and being extremely curious about, you know, what's the meaning of life? Mm. You know, we live and we die, and we've got the living thing down, but, you know, the whole rite of passage through the end of life is really ignored and scary. And so I worked with hospice or volunteered with hospice through college, mm-hmm. and had this inkling that I would one day do a film about the end of life. So Exit Music is about a 28-year-old who is an artist and musician, and he was born with an incurable illness called cystic fibrosis. So he's been living under the shadow of a death sentence for his entire life. So the film really picks up with the last year of Ethan's life, and I follow him through his journey through the dying process. And it's a very hard and emotional story, and it's a story not just about death, but about the love of family and the love of parents really trying to honor their son's end-of-life wishes.
Well, and I think, too, what I got from that is it's I'm so glad you said family, because we get this sense from Ethan, that he's deeply concerned about how his parents are perceiving this, and how he sees the physical manifestation of their caregiving and how they're reaching out to him and including him and all that. But he also talks about that emotional, spiritual, psychological kind of impact as well.
Yes, and that was one of the most surprising things to me filming the story. I mean, you go in with like a vision of what you think the story is going to be, and then of course it changes when you're there. And so I was very surprised that in talking with Ethan, that he was really holding on and holding on because of his parents, his concern for what his death would mean to them.
Yes, yes.
So it was really important for me to kind of use that as like a thread through the story. And the story really becomes a story about a father and son. Ethan was taken care of by his father. His father was a stay-at-home dad at the time that Ethan was born. His mother had the health insurance at that time, and so she had to stick with the job. And so he was left alone with his dad, who was this Vietnam veteran who was struggling with PTSD, and he really immersed Ethan into a world of imagination and art and humor. And what's really interesting, and I think what makes this film more approachable, is the fact that Ethan is this like witty, cynical guy. He has a very dark sense of humor. So despite the pain of watching this heartbreaking story, Ethan really is like a human. He's a real person. He's not just his
vision. I love, speaking of the comedic edge, which is so obviously quite dark, but I'm a huge Clint Eastwood fan. So his Clint Eastwood hat line, you know, is just, it's heartbreaking. And yet, just sort of so thoughtful as well. You know, what does he say? It's worth at least another 6 months, just how cool this hat looks on me.
Yeah, and you know what's so special is when Ethan died, he put the hat in his will to me. So I have that hat in my
crazy.
It's really so sweet, and I look at it every day.
I bet you do. He said at one point, you know, just to sort of talk a little bit, extend that conversation about the parents and the kids and the parents, that sort of the back and the forth, the two-way street, the circle of the family, I guess you could say. But he said at one point that he wanted to help his father reach peace. And, you know, Vietnam War vet, PTSD, didn't his father's father commit suicide as well?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, could you have picked a more difficult subject matter or two to make a film about, Cameron?
I know.
Covered all your bases.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because what kind of is revealed over the course of the film is, you know, the dad is, you know, Ethan's dying process is stirring up his own relationship with trauma and loss from his past, and him trying to like navigate that is really, really demanding and challenging.
You mentioned a couple minutes ago that, and I think I know exactly what you mean. You know, we got the whole living thing, you know, figured out. And I wonder to what degree the Exit Music kind of sort of almost contradicts that in a way, if you know what I'm saying. Like, so for sure, the film is about dying. It's about dying well. It's about end of life, and I want to talk about the doctor, Dr. McVeigh, I believe is her name, and that whole, you know, when is it living, when is it dying? Fascinating question. We need to get into some of that. But isn't this film too? And the stop motion animation and all of that, the metaphors of all these things, isn't it about living? Isn't it about being present? Being with our family, being with our loved ones. I mean, like any great doc, it's really layered, and yours is. And by the way, congratulations. I should have, right out of the gate, I should have said that. I mean, it's...
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's a remarkable, heartwarming, touching, difficult film. I hope that's all okay. But I was blown away on so many levels. Isn't it about being present?
I think so. And also, I think sickness and illness and having a terminal illness, it's often portrayed in the media or films where people are really identified with their disease, you know.
And
you kind of lose, like, your true essence.
Right.
And I really wanted to make a film that wasn't about a disease. This is a film about an artist, a family, who are being guided by love during the most heartbreaking and devastating experience of their life. And Ethan, like, the film is sprinkled with Ethan's stop-motion animation, which is super weird stuff.
Very militaristic, really, that's for sure.
Yeah, very full of life.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is the music, the entire soundtrack of the film was created by Ethan before he died.
Which is so amazing.
Yeah, he gave me a hard drive of all of his original music that he recorded in his bedroom. And I was able to work with a music producer to make it the entire soundtrack of the film. And so what that does is when Ethan is getting sicker and sicker, you know, he is losing the power of his essence and personality. But the music uplifts that spirit. So even when, you know, he's going through the dying process, you're feeling his energy through his music and his art.
What So what do you think it was? Oh man, so many questions, and we're just so not going to be able to get there. I can just so tell. But that's okay. Yeah. Maybe there's a part two here. But you know, just the notion of using stop motion, by the way, animation to me is just such a beautiful metaphor for so many reasons. And I think that's kind of what I meant about this life thing. I mean, one of the challenges I face, and my listeners will know, I talk often about. I have a heck of a time staying present. And, you know, I've got a 10 and a 12-year-old and becoming better at it all the time. And the kids are, Spencer and Victoria, helping me to be more present. And if I'm playing the game of life, then for crying out loud, play the game of life. You know, don't be thinking about what's next or the phone call or whatever it is. And that, to me, is what exit music is really about. I mean, it's obviously about all these other things, too. But it's remarkable how it's so layered. It comes out a little bit. So Eason's an artist. His father, love to hear more about the imagination side of things. What else did Ethan lean on? I mean, you know, he talks about, and it's heartbreaking to hear him talk about his friends and how, you know, he says something to the effect of that, you know, the word he uses too just is so tough that he's cumbersome to have around, and he feels as if his friends now see him that way. They see the disease, they don't see the person, I suppose, in some respects, or the effects of the disease, I guess. What else? I mean, I loved his last request too, essentially, Coke and Twizzlers. So I mean, he had some things that he found a lot of pleasure in life, and he recharged with that. Was there anything else that, you know?
I think he really was living for projects. I mean, when you are, when you have such a shortened life, you're living from one short-term goal to the next. So he was really just trying to record music and making those last stop-action animations. His friends, a lot of them kind of disappeared from the scene. He had a few good friends that still came around for jam sessions. But really, I mean, he was a lonely guy, you know? And I think my presence allowed him to really feel like he was taking part of something, you know, that he wasn't just dying alone in his house. You know, he was able to really open up and share his beauty and creativity, which was really special.
Would he have been that same lonely guy without the disease? Would he have been a loner and introvert, do you think?
I think on some level, it's just his nature, but he had lots of dreams of travel. He wanted to be, you know, like touring in a band, and he was studying culinary arts in college, but he had to leave college early, so he had lots of dreams, and that was really difficult. I mean, he says in the film, like, hell yeah, I have regrets. Like, anyone who says, I live life with no regrets is bullshit.
Right. So. He did seem to have that whole Seattle grunge thing going on. I think he could have pulled that off. I'm not afraid of death myself. It's the road getting there, he said. That's going to be the challenge. Is that again about him, and maybe this is where we can talk a little bit about Dr. McVeigh and saying, you know, when are you actually dying? When do you say, okay, I am done, this is finished? I love the fact that he lived from project to project. To me, that means he was present. You know, that he was living pretty well, and seems to me dying well too. As challenging and as difficult as it is.
And I think what makes dying so difficult is the fact that we're just extending. Medical interventions are allowing us to extend life well beyond what it was, you know, normal in, you know, 50 years ago or so. And so what that does, and at least for Ethan, he had some control over when to die because he was being kept alive by 24/7 oxygen and a whole slew of medication.
Right.
And at some point, I mean, those things were giving him quality of life. He was able to do those projects. But there's a line that's crossed which is, you know, Ursula McVeigh, his palliative care doctor, says in the film is, you know, where is it prolonging your life or is it prolonging your dying process? Mm-hmm. You know, he was kind of dying slowly. So that was, he knew that that was kind of going to be the case, and that what was so difficult for him.
He said he wasn't afraid of death, but the process, the road to get mm-hmm. there. And that, I mean, that speaks to so many things, right? I mean, it speaks to our, I mean, the communities we live in, our friends, you know, what kind of support mechanisms we have around us. His dad at one point, I think in the film, said that he was afraid personally, not Ethan, but his dad was afraid of the unknown and didn't know, you know, what to tell him. I guess at some points it must have been very difficult. You certainly give us the sense that this is a very open family. I mean, how can they not be with all the medications and so on and all the things that they're doing to keep their son going? But I wonder about those things that maybe they didn't talk about. I don't know that there were many, but I wonder what is that unknown that his dad, that his father was talking about? Is that like the afterlife? Is that what he was referring to? Like what's next kind of?
Yeah, I think it's, I think it's easy to kind of talk about hypotheticals, you
yep.
know, like,
yep.
oh, I'm not afraid of death. Like, it's okay. I'll be reincarnated.
Right.
You know, it's like you come up with some sort of answer to mm-hmm. quell mm-hmm. the deeper fear of like what is going to happen when we die. So I think that Ed felt like you really don't know what it's like to face death and to care for someone who you love, who's dying, until you're right up against it. And they've been on one level preparing for this their entire life,
right.
knowing that their
yep.
son would die young. But it wasn't until it was right at their face that they were being forced to look so deeply into the eyes of death and mortality that he didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to be, what to feel, how to console, because it's a scary unknown.
Yeah. Did the doctors essentially right out of the gate say that Ethan would be dead in several months, didn't they?
Yeah, so he just kept living
yeah.
past the doctor's prognoses from the age of 3 months on.
3 months. I thought it was 3 months.
And so what in the film, he is given at some point 2 weeks to live.
Right.
And so they're prepared. They're ready. They're geared up, ready to do this. And then he ends up living like 6 to 8 months longer.
You know, it's the photos. I'm going to be. I called the publicist a couple hours after watching the film, and I said, you know what? Don't ever send me a film like that again. And I was so teasing. It's pretty rare that this is just. Maybe it's a commentary more on the type of doc film that I watch. But I got to say, I mean. I was sobbing for all the right reasons. How's that?
That's what I'm trying to do.
I know you are, and I think it's remarkable that you've done it, and you've mixed it's beautiful that the film is his music and his own animation and their own family footage too, the shots of the school bus and the family photos. And I guess where I'm heading with all this is this one line when he's looking at the photos with his mom and he said something about, I think he was dressed up as Superman, and he said, I was Superman when I was little. And I think he was at the risk of sounding kind of corny. I think this guy was Superman the whole way through.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I mean, tell me about you in that sense. So if you agree with that, you're there, mm-hmm. you're filming, you're getting to know this family, you're on the inside. What are the insights you're getting about some of these things? I mean, these are big questions. This question that Dr. McVeigh asks
yeah.
about when are you prolonging dying? I mean, didn't she also say that a natural death would have been like when
two
he was
decades
eight,
ago.
Eight, yeah, 2 decades ago, 8 years old.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, profound ethical questions. And I know the U.S. and you're American, I'm Canadian. We're maybe a little farther ahead on that than you guys are.
Perhaps.
You know, laws about these laws around hastening death and so on. I'm really interested to hear some of your own personal insights that you take away when the camera's off and the editing, and you've left the editing room.
Yeah. Well, one thing that made the reason why I think Ethan did this film is because he appreciated that I was so frank with him. Mm. You know, people always beating around the bush, and friends wouldn't even acknowledge that he was like sick and dying. And so the first time I even met him, I was like, I know you're dying. It sucks. It's going to be hard, and I want to be there for you and do a film that really shows the world what it's like to face death, and especially as a young person. So from the get-go, there was just a lot of like transparency and trust there. But what I kind of realized, what got me into this topic originally to do the film, was about physician aid and dying, because Vermont at the time, which was across from Plattsburgh, across the lake from where Ethan lived, they became the fourth state to legalize physician aid in dying.
Hmm.
So I thought, I want to do a film about people who are taking advantage of that,
right,
and having some sort of autonomy over their end of life. And that's when I met Ursula McVeigh. I wrote a letter to the hospital saying, this is what I want to do. And she wrote back and she's like, number one, I have the most incredible person for you to meet, and I hope he will do this film. And number two is you should focus the film not on physician aid in dying, but on palliative care and the fact that people have rights to kind of have some sort of say in how they die through palliative care. I mean, because people are hooked up to so many machines and medicines, that palliative care is a means for giving people comfort through the end of life, not just through pain medication, but like spiritual care and counseling and helping people prioritize what's important. So that was kind of what I wanted this film to portray.
Well, I was in a personal conversation with a family just maybe this past week, and Elizabeth, my wife, and this other woman were talking about this film, and I was sort of talking about how you and I were going to be chatting and sort of the overarching theme and message, and the line was from this mom, oh yeah, I could pull the plug in a heartbeat. And it was just that sort of that immediacy, and we were kind of more like, not quite sure we're there yet. that we'd be, you know, that willing or that able or that that okay with it. And as you were just chatting about the laws and the legalities and some of your conversations with Dr. McVeigh, I just had this thought about, if it wasn't for electricity, if we didn't have so all of a sudden these ethical questions just are completely bound by technology. I mean, it's not that profound of an insight, but it's a major factor. Did you and Ethan ever get into that in a sense, off camera, where he would say things kind of like that came up near the end of the film? I'm just so done. If it wasn't for the machines, I would have been gone a long time ago. This all would have been over. Because he does ask his mom that at one point, which is an incredibly moving scene.
He asked. He tells his mom, when is this going to be over?
When is this going to be over? Yeah.
Yeah, I think what is interesting is, it is easy to talk about hypotheticals. Like, I could just pull the plug.
Yeah.
I don't want to suffer. But, and it's really easy to say that. And I think Ethan could have said that 5, 10 years ago.
Sure.
But it's different when you're actually having to make the decision.
100%. Yeah.
It's, you were kind of hardwired to live.
That's great. And it's a great line.
And I think that, Ethan didn't want to die. He didn't find closure. That's the other thing he was super annoyed about, is when people are like, oh, he's just trying to find closure. That's why he's holding on for so long. It's like, he didn't find closure. How can you? He had to at some point feel that the suffering wasn't worth it anymore.
Can you unpack that? By the way, that could have been the log line for the film. You could make lots of money. We're hardwired to live. You should turn that into a T-shirt or something.
I probably heard it from somewhere else.
Yeah, there's a campaign there. It's great. I love it.
I just made it my own.
So he didn't find closure. I don't know how. I remember a philosophy professor of mine who had come out of a Protestant or a Catholic background, so quite religious, a bit of an existentialist later in life, I think had become, an atheist essentially, or at least an agnostic. And he said, for all this talk, for all the philosophy I've done, Socrates said, philosophy is a rehearsal for dying. And this guy, David, he said, I'm just not okay with death. And, it's really stuck with me. It's going against the grain if we are in fact hardwired to live, right?
Mm-hmm.
How can you ever really find closure?
Right. No, it's a really good question.
I guess it's different for everyone. I think that, very much perspective, very much worldview. Very much the community, that you live in, I would think.
Yeah, and it's just the way we are dying these days is different than 50 years ago.
Right, right.
It's instead of like really sudden death, like heart attacks, accidents, it's these long drawn out terminal illnesses, chronic illnesses. So it's given us an opportunity to have to think about it more.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Or at least we hope that it's given us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly given us the opportunity. I'm not convinced that we do talk about these things very often or very well, and which is precisely why I hope everybody gets to see your film. And I really do believe your film is going to be something that's looked back on as being quite groundbreaking as far as not only just the conversation, but moving the dialogue forward with respect to the ethical, conversation and the legal implications as well. His dad, we're sadly gonna have to wrap up the conversation here soon, but his his father, Vietnam vet, PTSD, and help me out here, but at some point he was talking about about all the how he painted to deal with, I think, the fear and the anger and the distrust and guilt and all those PTSD like I suppose emotions. He said, I think, though, that some of that held all the good things back as well. Does that make...
Yeah.
Do you remember that? Well, you must remember that part. It's kind of a silly question.
Referring to dealing with PTSD and how he kind of felt locked in himself.
Right.
Like he wasn't able to fully experience pain and joy and the full spectrum of like living, that it just kind of really held him back emotionally. And so watching his son die really was kind of stirring up all of those feelings again.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if that's sort of connected to the Ethan, the closure question around Ethan as well, right? We're all kind of struggling, I suppose, in our own way to lean into this hard wiring of towards life, but so many things get in the way of that.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, the interesting thing is death is happening all the time.
Right.
And it's
right.
touching people's lives all the time. And it's a very private, kind of happens behind closed doors, vulnerable experience. And then when you come out of it, the community doesn't know how to respond and how to provide support, and so what happens is people like back away and kind of abandon the people that need the support. So what I feel like this film does, it's like the Rice family is like holding all of our hands and like bringing us into the experience, so we feel like we're there. And part of what makes the film feel like that is that the dad who had been filming Ethan his entire youth growing up, I gave him a camera. And so it kind of goes back and forth between my footage and through a father's gaze. So it's extremely intimate, and they've given us such a gift to be able to walk us through this experience.
It's a huge gift. Must have been such a privilege for you to be a part of it. Very difficult, I would think, at many times. And I would imagine, back to the closure thing, I would think as parents, I mean, I think I'd want to share that with others, to say, here's how we dealt with it. Here, maybe someone else can learn from this, right? Maybe somebody else can help make sense of all this.
Yeah, and they really were being guided by Ethan. I don't know if they would have chosen to do it themselves.
Interesting.
But yeah, you know, when they reflect on it, they were just. I think they were a little nervous about how people would respond to
the
film.
I bet.
But it's been an incredible response.
Yeah.
We get little love letters from people who've seen the film, and I always pass them on to the family.
That's amazing. Can we, as we close here, just to turn it on its head, can you talk a little bit about the opening? You know, sort of your establishing shot and the shots in the film with Ethan on the breathing machine, sitting on his bed, and I don't know if you actually ask him a direct question in the film or not, but he talks about.
Yeah, I didn't really ask him the direct question, but the way the film opens is he's sitting quietly on a hospital bed with the machine, kind of blowing air up his nose, and he just says, "Sad." And he asks himself the question, how do you feel about dying? And he's like, I feel sad. And he says it in the most ironic, sarcastic way, which kind of pokes fun at how, you know, other stories about people like him are often told in a very sentimental way. And he's just kind of fuck that. he's like, I feel sad. He's just poking fun of it. And I think it sets the tone of dark humor that's going to move forward through the film.
Yeah. It gives us kind of an insight into him right out of the gate. It almost, if you go in and I don't know if this is the right way to put it, but let's say you have a conservative outlook on end of life or these kinds of issues ethically, you might go, wow, that's pretty, pretty trite way to say that, you know, but as you look back after having seen the film, this is a huge insight into this young Superman, you know?
Right. Exactly.
It's
beautiful. I mean, it's an impossible question to answer.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. No, it truly is. Well, listen, I congratulations again, and I've had such a great time chatting and about such a difficult issue. But what a beautiful, beautiful and tragic film that you've made, and I really do hope, Cameron, that everybody gets to see it. Can I ask you quickly what is next for you guys? Are you, pushing this film? Have you got other ideas in mind on the table now?
Yeah, well, we're starting to bring this film out more. We are designing kind of a campaign for outreach.
Oh, good.
Trying to bring this film into communities and healthcare communities, hospitals, that sort of thing.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And it will be on PBS. We're still waiting on our broadcast date.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, congratulations on it all. We've been talking with Cameron Molyneux about her new film, Exit Music. Cameron, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a real honor to speak with you today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.